from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's forum, Robert Haas was United States Poet Laureate from 1995 to 1997 when he began promoting eco-literacy and later created River of Words, an organization that teaches school kids about environmental awareness. His wife, poet Brenda Hillman, also centers her writing and activism on the natural world. Haas and Hillman join us to discuss exploring nature through poetry and their work for environmental causes and much more after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Bay Area poets and activists Robert Haas and Brenda Hillman are with us this hour. They are man and wife, and they are much celebrated for their poetry, both award-winning poets and both politically active. Brenda Hillman has been in Code Pink, and both were arrested, as many of you may recall, during one of the East Bay occupation protests. Bob Haas was U.S. Poet Laureate and is a recipient of both a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize. He teaches at UC Berkeley, and Brenda Hillman teaches at St. Mary's. And both Robert Haas and Brenda Hillman, as I said, are with us for this second hour. And I want to actually, before I say hello to them officially, I want to mention a few things that you probably ought to know. Bob Haas will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 p.m. as part of the January Team Speaker Series at St. Mary's College at the Soda Center. His speech is entitled Thinking About Ovid, you say tomato, I say tomato, in the 21st century, metamorphosis, myth, and the carbon cycle. And Brenda Hillman is Olivia C. Filippi Professor of Poetry at St. Mary's. Her most recent book is Seasonal Works with Letters on Fire. Previous collection, Practical Water, won the L.A. Times Book Award. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great, always delighted to be here.
To have you here. And I'm going to lead this discussion with a question that you are probably asked many times, but how do you work together as poets? How do you make that work?
Well, in very fancy and simple ways, I think. From our standpoint, we love each other very much, and we recognize we're in the same field, and we're both educators, so we have a lot to talk about.
And it works.
As a practical matter, I think we it's like parallel play. Is one part of it. Somebody said that there are two kinds of artists, obsessives and hysterics. And if that's true, I think I'm the hysteric and Brenda's the obsessive. So, for example, if we meet in the kitchen in mid-morning and she says, I'm going crazy because all of these poems have 12 lines and I have this wonderful poem, but it's 13 lines. And I just don't know what to do. And I'll say, no problem. And she'll say, you are of no use to me.
I think it's...
12 is 12.
It's wonderful to hear a man talk about himself as a hysteric, particularly when you look back at the history of that word with its gynecological etymology. And we're going to ask both of you to read. I'm just interested, though, in finding something out about reading poetry when you either read together as man and wife or when you read separately. The last poet we had on fairly recently was Gary Snyder, whom I know both of you admire and who, like both of you, is very dedicated to ecology and the like. And I was following the text, and it was changing. When you read poems, do they change for you? And Snyder said they always change for him.
They certainly do for me. And I always think of the anecdote about Matisse. They had to take his paintbrushes away from him as he entered an exhibition because he would go over to his paintings and do little doodles. And I feel like that with my books. When the books come out, I want to go on editing because I work maybe 100 drafts on a poem sometimes.
How many drafts do you do, Robert?
Well, it varies a lot.
I mean, the obsessive does 100. How many does the hysterical?
Brenda has said that she can work on a poem and that by the time she's finished, because she kind of works like a novel as she pulls, there can be not a word from the first draft in the final. That must be very rare, though, right?
That that's pretty rare. But, you know, I copy over and over and over by hand. And my theory is that it's very hard to copy by hand what isn't good. So you have to just keep letting go, letting go, letting go. And as we talked about in Esalen, I am not a good Buddhist. I don't like to let go very easily.
But I'm not a good Buddhist because I get so angry when somebody cuts me off. but I'm not a Buddhist anyway.
Well, you can be a Buddhist. With Allen Ginsberg has a haiku in which he says, driving around and can't find a damn parking place for my meditation hour, right?
Yeah, I love that. Actually, Brenda, I was reading a quote of yours that I found myself intrigued by, just since we're talking about poets and how they work through the process of writing verse. It said, make form, allow form, but you're always bound to fail. Is maybe that why you're a bit obsessive?
Well, you know, I love coming up with a form in advance that may be in some way sort of in mystical relationship to the subject matter, but you have to certainly be ready to let it unravel itself as it goes along, because it really is about the process and about receiving the intuition as you go. And that's also, you know, my practice of daily life. You know, we talked about that. But I think that idea that you can set yourself a form or a task and then ceaselessly revise as you go along. And that is also the way I think you have to proceed as an activist and probably as a parent and as a teacher. And, you know, I'm sure in your various professions that you're always revising. So that sense.
Revision's good and necessary. Both of you, Bob, have become identified with eco-literacy and environmental movement. And to a great extent, this is also the job of an educator. I mean, it's in your poetry, but it's also in the kind of activist political work you do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, at a certain point, I guess it was 15 years ago, I just decided that I wanted to be, that it was important to teach in this area. So I teamed up with a friend, Professor Gary Sposito, who's a very eminent geochemist, and we invented a course for Berkeley freshmen, which we modestly called The Earth and How to Think About It, and tried to begin to see how we could put science and environmental history, environmental philosophy, and literature together to sort of lay foundations for an education. And
what was on your reading list, and what did you have?
Well, at the beginning, I didn't know what I was doing at all, and so my reading list, I didn't know whether I should include early Buddhist texts on the nature of nature and Plato, or Neoplatonists on honeycombs and their geometry, and Galileo looking at moons. And then I realized that I'd never get anywhere, so I better start with California. So that's pretty much where we start now, with California writers and some of the classic writers, Rachel Carson, Aldo Leopold, John Muir, and the natural history, environmental writing tradition.
And where do you come into this, Brenda, in terms of your life and work?
Well, you know, I teach both undergraduates and graduate students at St. Mary's, and right now we're doing an eco-poetics course for our January term, which is a really special feature of St. Mary's. We have this intense January term, which is a one-month-long course, and I have the most fantastic class. It's 13 undergraduates and about 8 graduate students, and they cover their range in age 4 decades, and they're explorers. They're willing to open up the most difficult or challenging poem and really just dive in and read it, because...
Like what kind of poems?
Well, poetry of a sort of eco-poetics very contemporary eco-poetics that may come to an idea of poetry that isn't classical or easy or traditional. So, and this includes essays by theorists. There's a poet, Jonathan Skinner, who's really got a sort of radical approach to eco-poetry. Poems that include bits of prose, bits of research, data, very widely varying formats, so you'll have just lists of words that may not have a grammatical structure. And all of these are sort of predicated on the notion that what used to be the nature poem has to be constantly reinventing itself in light of environmental, you know, some would say disaster, challenge, what we're facing now with the drought, things that are out of our control, and yet still include and love what poetry is best at, which is sort of investigating the mystery of existence and the mystery of consciousness and all of these things. And these wonderful students, I mean, I just adore them. They just roll up their sleeves and they get in there and they disagree. You know, some of them have come to poetry thinking poetry should rhyme and it should be pleasant and nice. And the poems don't always have bad good news. Sometimes they have terrible news, you know. So it's
well. I remember Brecht's line: "The man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news." But that's a that's a bit of a downer, to be sure. I want to hear both of you read, and I'm going to ask both of you to read. But before that, I noticed Brenda, you wrote about your favorite Bob Haas poem, which I think may still hold up as a supple wreath of myrtle. What's your favorite Brenda? Do you have a favorite Brenda Hillman poem, Bob?
No, I don't have one favorite, though there are poems I love a lot and come back to.
Sorry, I put the husband on the spot like Irene said here.
What kind of poems that you read to pick, you know, one kind of reading poets do is before you start writing, you read something to remind you of what the art could do, kind of set the bar. And there are a couple of poems of hers. Wind Treaties is one for me, a gorgeous poem she wrote about when we were living in Berlin and for several months. There are whole books, her Death Tractates, which is a book-long poem about mourning in the California spring, is a book I absolutely love. And I'm with the new book, I'm still learning it and coming to find the poems that I are going to be the touchstones for me in that book.
Well, in the Poetry Foundation query as to favorite Bob Haas poems, which included Brenda's selection of your poem, Primo Triplet selected one of my Bob Haas favorite poems, which I think last time you were on, you recited, Meditation at Lagunitas. And it was curious what she said about that poem. She says, it's one of the poems that can save you. I was struck by that. I mean, the poetry can actually save people. I mean, you know, it is certainly vital in many people's lives and maybe not vital enough in other people's lives. But I also have a quote from Stanley Kunitz who said, reading Bob Haas is like stepping into the ocean when the temperature of the ocean is not much different than that of the air. You scarcely know until you feel the undertow tug at you that you have entered into another element. And this is coming from one of my favorite poets. I mean, the fact of the matter is that what's interesting here is you're both writing about the elements. I mean, Brenda's been writing about the elements for quite some time now, and you stay with the elements in an elemental way. I mean, it's why I suppose on a couple of occasions you've said here on the air and in other contexts, you never tire of teaching Whitman.
Yeah. Mm.
Who do you never tire of teaching?
Well,
Dickinson?
I never tire of teaching Dickinson. I never tire of teaching Stevens, the great modernists. Robert Duncan is an impassioned favorite. He's a great San Francisco writer. I was friends with Barbara Guest. I love her poetry. And Gary Snyder, who was recently on, I think he just yields and yields. You know, I was thinking about Eliot this week because the students that students that I was talking about, we read The Wasteland in a circle in voices. So I think the Eliot yields and yields and yields. I have to say, when I think about Bob's work, there's just such a huge range. And The Subtle Wreath of Myrtle is a favorite.
It's a Nietzsche poem.
I have hundreds of favorites of Bob's poems. But that one I had just been thinking about a lot. But yeah.
Would you honor us by reading something from your work? Wife Goes First here?
Sure. This book, Seasonal Works with Letters on Fire, is you mentioned, meditation on the elements. It's the fourth in a tetralogy of books about the elements that has taken me a couple decades to work on. And I was trying to track the micro seasons of California, just the little micro seasons that include psychological moments. And as we're saying, I guess there's a sense that the invisible is also an element, that spiritual depth is kind of accesses other elements. So anyway, this is the seasonal moment that we're just about to enter between semesters. Between semesters, the fragments follow us. As a heron stalks the smart frog, time stabs the mini Brenda. We had a winter panic, then it grew. Valved season, approaching in bulk, sounds of the newly dead. Eee! Your verbs do little flips like Russian gymnasts. Thousands of herring purr through the eelgrass, and at the end of the middle of the end of empire, plastic buoys, rope, Arabic bronze kelp washed up. Oh, take me too, present tense. Take us, driftwood, each aperture so mongrel-sized. Across Tamales, children merge with screens, and further in, pre-rectangles on the backs of turtles. There is sexual laughter in the dune grass. Over the shards, stars buckle and wheel. Some of the fragments are lost, Osiris. Your lover will find them with her quantum style.
Oh, there's so much packed in there. I want to meet the mini Brenda, too.
Isn't that amazing and strange? So is the mini Brenda you identifying with the stickleback that's being eaten by the
I was thinking about the heron stabbing. That I was feeling so, you know how you feel besieged between semesters because you just don't know how you're going to get enough done. So I was thinking about time. This is a book about time, really, and nature and nature of time. And I was thinking, wow, the heron is stabbing the frog. Time is stabbing the mini Brenda. The other thing I forgot to mention is Imbolc is the candle mass. It's the exact halfway point between solstice and equinox.
Read the phrase again in which it occurs.
Oh, valved season approaching Imbolc, sounds of the newly dead.
Yeah. One of the things living with her is it makes my own imagination feel very obvious to me because she has this constantly inventive, witty, dark,
transforming. She is amazingly inventive. Yeah. I'm looking, speaking about the two of you living together, an email from a listener says, Michael, twice you refer to Robert Hass and Brenda Hillman as man and wife. This is clearly off topic, but I wonder if husband and wife would be their preference.
I had not ever thought about that. What do you think?
Partners. I don't really. Yeah. Well, man and wife seems traditional.
Old school. Yeah.
Traditional. Yeah.
And I can be old school. Yeah. Bob, you going to read something for us?
Well, I didn't know what to read. And then I thought in relation to this poem of Brenda's, I could read something. But I want hearing it this time, I thought there is sexual laughter in the dune grass. I wouldn't mind having that on my gravestone. So this is not this year, though today we're getting the beginning of that drizzly weather that we should have gotten. This is Abbott's Lagoon, October. It's Abbott's Lagoon out in West Marin. The first thing that is apt to raise your eyes, above the dove gray and silvery thickets of lupin and coyote bush and artichoke thistle on the sandy winding path from the parking lot to the beach at Abbott's Lagoon is the white flash of the marsh hawk's rump as it skims low over the coastal scrub. White-crowned sparrows, loud in the lupin, even in October, even in a drizzly rain, startle and disappear. The bush rabbits freeze as you walk toward them, then bolt and disappear. And the burbling songs and clucks of the quail that you may not even have noticed you were noticing go mute, and you are there in October and the rain, and the hawk soars past, first hawk, then shadow of a hawk, not much shadow in the rain, low sun silvering through clouds a little to the west. It's almost sundown. And this is that new weather at the beginning of the middle of the California fall, when a rain puts an end to the long, sweet days of our September, when the skies are clear, days mild, and the roots of the plants have gripped down into 5 or 6 month drought, have licked all the moisture they are going to lick from the summer fogs, and it is very good to be walking because you can almost hear the earth sigh as it sucks up the first rain here where mid-October is the beginning of winter, which is the beginning of a spring greening as if the sound you were hearing were spring and winter lying down in one another's arms. Under the hawk's shadow, among the coastal scrub, ocean in the distance, and the faintest sound of surf, and a few egrets, bright white, working the reeds at the water's edge in October in the rain.
Oh, Wonderful. Both of you, thank you so much. I'm just knocked out by not only the observational power, but what's packed into these poems that you've just read. I mean, this is a man who uses words too much in his life, and I'm a little bit caught up in terms of my own attempt here to express what's ineffable about those. Those poems need to be studied is really what I'm trying to say here. They need to be studied just like the poets that you teach and that I teach. Thank you both for that reading. I'm going to actually open the phone lines and invite listeners. When we have poets on, we'd like to ask you what poetry matters to you. And, of course, it's an opportunity, of course, to talk directly to either Brenda or Robert Haas or both of them about their work, about their lives, about their political activism. Brenda is still in Code Pink, still have member in good standing and all that. But we'd like to also engage you in the question that comes up often in my mind, and that is, which poets make a difference in your life and why? And certainly these two poets do in mine, obviously. We welcome your calls. Toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And please feel free to join the program now. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments immediately onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And, of course, you can go to our Facebook page. And I also want to talk about how you make a living writing poetry. Of course, you both teach. But Bob Haas once revealed to me the fact that, venerable poet though he is, U.S. Poet Laureate and all that, none of those poetry books have made money. So when young people come and ask for advice and say, how can I make a living writing poetry? Well, we'll get to that when we return. We'll also get to your calls and emails. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Robert Haas and Brenda Hillman, talking about poetry, hearing them read their poetry, and also talking about environmental activism, which has been a very important part of both of their lives together as husband and wife, man and wife, whatever you prefer. Bob Haas is former poet laureate and winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. He's professor of poetry and poetics at UC Berkeley, and he'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7 p.m. as part of the January term speaker series at St. Mary's College at the Soda Center, and the speech is titled Thinking About Ovid in the 21st Century, Metamorphosis, Myth, and the Carbon Cycle. And Brenda Hillman is Olivia C. Filippi Professor of Poetry at St. Mary's College, where they have a new president, in fact. It's been on this program a number of times. And her most recent book is Seasonal Works with Letters on Fire. Her previous collection, Practical Water, won the L.A. Times Book Award. And you've got we talk about eco-literacy. You've got an anthology that maybe we should mention here, Brenda. Yeah.
Yes. Well, in the eco-poetics course, I've been using two anthologies, the Eco-Poetry Anthology, which is edited by Ann Fisher-Wirth and Laura Gray Street, and another one called the Arcadia Project, which is edited by Joshua Corey and G.C. Waldrop. And they approach the topic from, or topics, from kind of different styles. The Eco-Poetry Anthology has a more historic approach, so it actually starts with Whitman and goes through the modernists and then takes up contemporary poets of various kinds. And Arcadia Project is more, sort of the latest thing in experimental writing that may be pushing the envelope of what an eco poem is, what a nature poem has become, what this eco poetics thing is, and it's organized in a really fascinating way. So I decided to use both of these to give the students a chance to compare those approaches, historical versus sort of, avant-garde.
Let me ask, before we bring in our callers and our listeners, I don't know if you knew Ted Rozak, who was a friend, a good friend, and whom I miss. For the benefit of listeners, he was really an extraordinary kind of polymath, a historian by training, but he did a book called The Making of the Counterculture, which was a big book back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of book on growing old, on the environment, a lot of work particularly on the environment. And he talked at one point about, and I talked with him about this on the air, he wrote a piece in the New York Times about it, environmental triage. When you have so many environmental issues, the difficulty, if you're committed to saving the planet, doing as much as you can about environmental abuses and teaching ecological literacy and so forth, where do you put the top priority? There's just so much you can give of yourself or that you can help. What are the main – I mean, if you had to put a cause at the top is really what I'm asking you here in terms of eco-literacy. What's the top cause for you?
Well, we've been talking about education. I mean, I guess top cause would have to be education. For me, having people understand that there's a deep connection between the spiritual and literary health of a culture and what we're doing to the environment. So in the classroom is the top priority for me. But in terms of my activism, definitely Keystone Pipeline. I'm very concerned about the Keystone, upset about the Keystone possibility, very concerned about...
of course, the counter-argument always is, but it's giving people jobs and we need to have people employed.
We were just talking about that. You were saying the Keystone is going to produce in the United States, the predictions are 58 permanent jobs.
At the last protest that I attended and had some energy.
Do you attend protests? Is that the right verb?
I attended and jumped up and down. And the information that we received was that 58 permanent jobs and 1,000 temporary jobs. Is that really worth it? You know, the volatility of this tar sand conduction across lands that may be have their aquifer completely ruined, so that's very high on my priority, being, extremely upset about what corporations are doing to farmers.
And, did you hear the president's speech last night, which we spoke about in the first hour? Because he said, climate change is a fact, and he was very emphatic about that.
Well,
he didn't mention the Keystone Pipeline, but there are those like Bill McKibben who make that connection between the Keystone Pipeline and climate change.
Yes, and I wish he would use the K word. the generality of saying that we're achieving energy independence. How about achieving alternative energy independence. That's what I would like for him to.
I want to read something here that I want listeners to know about, and then I'm going to go to listeners' calls and emails, and you can join us by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. You can also join us in conversation or let us know what poets inspire you by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment. But in the great tradition of California poets like Robert Haas and Brenda Hillman, has us wanting some drought-inspired poetry, specifically haikus. We've set up a drought Tumblr at stateofdrought.tumblr.com. So get writing and post your best parched poetry to stateofdrought.tumblr.com. That's stateofdrought.tumblr.com. And we asked on Facebook, how important is poetry to you? How, if at all, do you manage to keep it in your life? Sharon writes, I'm only now learning to appreciate poetry in my middle age. Kevin says, I subscribe to Poetry Magazine and check out books from the library, always looking good for good poems and good poets. And here's Brooke, who writes, please ask Mr. Haas about the program that Women Sing, an East Bay Women's Choral, has established, encouraging young composers to use the river words poetry in new works.
Yeah, thank the listener for asking about that. One of the things that I have done, I was going to say about the priorities to begin with, that my first priority has been self-education, that in order to know what's going on, let alone to know this place where we live and have become responsible for, and to teach our kids to be responsible for, teaching it to myself has been my top priority, which also turns out to be a terrific pleasure. It means I'm required to go hiking a lot and also to read. One of the things that I did when I started thinking that I should be doing something was with others, particularly with Pamela Michael, who was then the development director for International Rivers, would start a program called River of Words, which encourages children to make art and poetry out of their watersheds, which we thought would encourage teachers to teach children to be conscious of what their watersheds were as a way of beginning environmental literacy education using the senses and imaginations of the kids from an early age. So River of Words is now in thousands of classrooms all over the country, and each year we give prizes to kids of different ages. One of the upshots of this and publishing books of children's art and poetry about their natural environment is a wonderful choral group in Contra Costa County, which does concerts all over the world, has begun to encourage young composers to do settings of the poems written by young poets about the natural world. And so my hope about this was like the programs we grew up with. I don't know, did you have the I Speak for Democracy speaking contests? These various.
Sorry to say, I did not. But then I grew up in a backwater in Ohio. Called Cleveland.
In California, every child had, there were three or four things, propaganda of things that for children programs. I wanted there to be every year in every classroom in the country a moment when the teachers told the kids to think about how water and energy flows through their environment and what life forms it supports, and then tell them to make art or make poetry out of their own experience of being out of doors. And that program is now part of the Center for Environmental Literacy at St. Mary's College. It got adopted there, so it connected to a school of education, which is terrific. And it's had some success in doing what I had dreamed of.
I want to read one tweet, and then we'll go to the calls. The tweet is from Annie, who says, Brenda saved my life at St. Mary's College, and I miss her every day. She still makes life better every time I read her work. Let me go to our callers, and we'll begin, Thomas, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just, so many things to touch base on, but Robert, when you were just speaking about watershed education, I actually just wrote a poem called Watershed Google about trying to get Google to do a street view or a trail view of the Pacific Crest Trail and then use that as an educational tool for schools to teach students all along the spine of California to know what watershed they live in. And but I am calling because a little bit of a self-promotion and saying I really appreciate your work, and I'm hoping I can use it in my coffee bags. I'm a coffee roaster in San Francisco called Nomadic Ground, and I print my bags on a nice antique letter press, and I put a poem in every bag from local poets. And
you got some Bob Haas and Brenda Hillman material in there?
Well, that's why I'm calling.
Ah.
I would love to put interrupted meditation in the bags. I don't know if I can get permission over the phone, but I'd love to see if I could do that. pretty much why I'm calling, but I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for this, and fellow poets really appreciate you as a great teacher and voice of poetry in the Bay Area.
Well, thank you, Thomas, for the call. So what do you tell these young fledgling poets who come to you seeking wisdom and saying, yeah, but how can I make a living being a poet? Or can I make a living being a poet?
Yeah. I tell them that almost every artist in America has two jobs for their entire life, except for a few actors and singers. and that get used to it.
Brenda, here's a counter-argument from Bill online, who says the counter-argument to Keystone opposition is that the alternative is shipping oil by rail, which is less efficient and less safe.
Hmm. Well, you know, if we were really thinking about how the oil would benefit the people, you know, that are going to be endangered by it, I think there would be something to be said for shipping the oil across lands that were going to be endangered, you know, the middle of the country. But the fact is, it's going to be shipped overseas no matter what. It's going to be shipped overseas if it goes through the middle of the country, endangering that amazing aquifer. The fact is, we don't need, we should not be extracting tar sands. It's a really icky form. I know that's refined language.
Uber icky.
Uber icky form of energy. It's highly volatile. It's going to corrode these pipes, and it's bad business. We need to be putting our energy and money into alternatives, and that's where we want president's energy, Congress energy, and corporations wake up. You know,
UI would be a good tweet word. Just for Uber icky.
Uber icky.
How did it go yesterday? UI.
Robert, you're on with us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm honored and privileged to speak to Robert and Brenda. Just to address briefly that last comment about how can you make a living, I studied creative writing at San Francisco State in the early 70s. And today, through many, many circumstances, I run a company of about 20 people. I'm very successful and happy, and I know it was because that I love the written word and the spoken word, and I was able to communicate. And so every artist, every poet should know that there is something for them out there if they can only practice that love of the language.
Did you study with Francis Mays or Kathleen Fraser? Who did you study with there?
I did not. I studied with Jonathan Middlebrook was there.
He's a lit guy, like me.
Pardon me?
He's a lit guy, like me. You said you studied poetry.
Yeah, he's a lit guy.
Yeah.
Dick Wadlet. Dick Wadlet got me started on Blake. I was a physics major, and I took a class from Dick Wadlet, and I walked downstairs and signed up for creative writing after reading Blake.
And reading Blake and doing all this poetry reading has helped you in life, is really what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And the point the sort of end point I wanted to make in that regard is for the last 6 or 7 years, my family has been sponsoring a poetry prize at Robert Haas's old high school in Marin County. We're very happy to do that. And I can tell you, these days, the poetry that means the most to me is the poetry that is written by every student in this high school. It's now built into part of the curriculum, and we're just so proud to be a part of that.
Well, thank you for that call, and I keep thinking for some reason of Marianne Moore's "I Too Dislike It." You know, I mean, there's real stuff in there. I mean, people don't necessarily realize how real it can be. And here's Faiza, who writes, "One of my favorite pastimes is reading poetry while hiking. I usually read Walt Whitman or Gary Snyder. Any other poems that the guests might suggest?"
Bob and I teach at Squaw Valley Community, and after the week at Squaw Valley, I think a couple of years ago, we decided we would memorize Yeats' Byzantium, which is about the opposite of a nature poem as you can get. And
Byzantium was old age to Yeats, really.
Yeah, it was, but it's amazing how unnatural that. I mean, it really is actually making the case for how art is the thing to be considered as the highest form, that the makings of the mind, making something out of reality, are, you know, even greater than so-called nature. And so it was amazing to be memorizing this poem, walking along on this in this wilderness, this natural beauty, and I truly think that it's possible to be postmodern and romantic at the same time. That you can have in your heart this sense of that there's a non-human world, that there's a beyond human world and a spirit world that is completely, in some way, inaccessible to our experience, and yet we use our human experience and even our contemporary experience to translate it. So I don't know. I'm very optimistic about poetry, if not optimistic about.
Well, I just had an image for some reason going through my head, Robert, of you walking through woods reciting Milosh. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. Do you actually,
well,
indeed?
You know, I have poems running through my head, so of course sometimes I do. But I, in the manner of husband and wife or man and wife, I found myself wanting to revise Brenda's narrative and say, we didn't decide to memorize poems. She decided to memorize poems, and I was against it. I thought, it's enough. We were walking the trail
Desolation
from
Wilderness.
Pfeiffer to Emerald Bay. Mm. Those are gorgeous walks along Lake Tahoe. The water is deep marine, sky incredibly blue, great smell of pines, little movement of birds in the trees. And I didn't want to hear Yeats. And she was walking behind me. Do you remember how that poem begins, the Byzantium?
The Emperor's Drunken Soldiers.
Yeah, it was the first line. I mean, Yeats was writing a poem this in 1930s or something about what was then the highest, most urban, most sophisticated civilization in the world in the middle of the night, called Byzantium. And it begins, "The Emperor's Drunken Soldiers Abed." And she was saying it over and over to herself. And I went from hating the idea of memorizing poems on the trail to loving hearing this poem recited against this startlingly beautiful landscape we were walking through. So I recommend, if not memorizing poems, reading poems aloud to yourself sometimes.
Well, here's a bit of a strange thought along those lines. The first poem I had to memorize in Agnes Reagan's English class was "Oh, to Be in England Now That April's There." And I'm walking one day and that line comes into my head, and then April is the cruelest month immediately followed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Can you now recite "Oh, to Be in England"?
I probably could if pushed, but let me go to another caller in the meantime. Dan, yeah, you're on. Hi.
How's it going, guys? Thank you for taking my call. I'm sitting on the waterfront here looking at a great example of what I would call environmental poetry, the tide-driven pipe organs that are built in by the marina there, by the yacht club, and producing great sounds. But I wanted to ask you when you thought, or do you recall that moment growing up when poetry, in a sense, was given to you? Because I remember it very distinctly, in my case, a great man, George Dunlop, who studied with Frost, was teaching me poetry in high school. He had us read Leda and the Swan. and
in high school, one of the sexiest poems in the English language.
Well, he challenged us as to what it was about, and I stepped forward and said, you know, what I thought, and I was, and everybody in the class and their coat and ties went, no, it's not possible. And George Dunlop said, "You're 100% correct." And
that must have felt good. But Dan, let me get to your question, because we're coming up on a pledge break here. I mean, moment that you realize, either of you, both of you?
Well, I have to say, I had a pretty literary family, and we started with, you know, I grew up fairly spiritual, intense family. I grew up hearing Ecclesiastes, you know, which is a very somber book of the Bible, and by the way, a great eco poem.
Also, a great poem in turn. I remember Joan Didion telling me in an interview that the cadences and the sounds affected her more than anything she read throughout her childhood.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And Whitman, too. And remember thy creator in the days of thy youth when the evil days come not. And, you know, that sort of cadence, that long, long sentence of the last book. And I think it's completely amazing.
Can I get you on record here, Bob? We got to do a quick break.
Well, I was trying to go to poetry, poem poetry, but then I thought, hearing you talk about that, that probably for me, I was raised a Catholic, and so it was the rhythms of the liturgy, both in Latin, and I was an altar boy, so one of the first things we learned to recite is from one of the old poems of David. It begins, intro ebo altari Dei, I will go into the altar of God, to God the joy of my youth. So I think it was the rhythm and incantation of litany and prayer, probably.
And you are listening to Forum. We're talking to Robert Haas and Brenda Hillman. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED Public Radio, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to a caller from East Oakland. Marga, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. And I want to thank your guests and just say that because of River of Words and Watershed, I had my most wonderful poetry experience because the children did a reading at Arroyo Viejo Park. They didn't do a reading. They wrote poems about how they felt about the creek getting polluted and how they felt about nature. And I still am thinking about it and about how to write poetry. And oh, I am so grateful that you opened those doors, the floodgates for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to hear from you. And we'll hear from another caller, and that's Neil. Morning.
Yeah, an idle question. Does Bob Dylan count as a poet? And if so, exactly how good do you think he is? Or bad?
Well, I think he should have gotten the Nobel Prize about 5 sessions ago. I don't know why he hasn't. I think he's a great, great artist, and those definitions of poetry, line by line, I think his writings hold up.
Wasn't Allen Ginsberg who said the greatest American poet is Smokey Robinson? And I remember when I started teaching literature, we thought, yeah, let's teach Dylan as a poet. Let's teach Leonard Cohen as a poet. I mean, they are poets.
Great.
Thank you for the call, Neil. And one more call from Sacramento. Catherine, hi.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking the call. I was a Bard of Baltimore when I was 12 years old, but right now I've been advocating for the United Nations Association here on a carbon tax. I haven't put it into a poem, but I wondered, considering the commitment that Bob and Brenda have to the environment, how they feel about a carbon tax that would recognize the fact that the roads are not free, that we need to have full cost pricing on carbon.
Yeah, well, I agree entirely. I mean, I think there are two ways that this whole problem can't be hypothetical much longer, whether Keystone is built or not. And the way to a solution in this country, which consumes 29% of the fossil fuel in the world, has got to be a combination of a carbon tax and a carbon cap. And they're doable. It can actually be done. I think it will be done in the next 5 years. Maybe it will be 10 years. But there has to be a carbon cap. That is, there has to be some agreement at some level at which we stop doing this. because the train has left the station, as everyone said, on global warming. And the second thing is I agree with you entirely, and I salute the work you're doing. A carbon tax has to happen.
And also write your poem as well.
Yeah, we're still thinking, many of us, that you guys are the unacknowledged legislators having that kind of effect on the body politic, or one would hope, although we certainly need more people to read poetry and appreciate poetry. In fact, Dan writes, I have trouble reconciling, and you must hear this a lot, the symbolism of poetry against having an effective message. Is this a problem with art or just me?
I think I can speak to that because we've talked about it a lot in my class. I feel as if poetry and literature in general helps us engage all parts of the mind, and so it doesn't leave out the rational to say that we're operating a lot on a dream level or symbolic level throughout much of our day. I think even people that we consider highly rational are driven more by their dreams than we might think. And so to study poetry, to look at poetry, to analyze the way language works in a poem is not to disengage the dream nature of it. So I don't know. I think you can have both in that way. Yeah.
Well, on that note, thank you both very much for being here and for the work you do. And again, Bob Haas will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the January Term Speaker Series at St. Mary's. And you're both great. Great to have you.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Brenda Hillman and Robert Haas.
Thank you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion about poetry and poetry love, or poetry hate for that matter, by going online, kqed.org/forum, or going to our Facebook page. And we always would enjoy hearing from you, not only about what you like, but what you're critical of, and any ideas you have for further forum programming. kqed.org is the email address. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.